Hello, and welcome to another Emmy Contender edition of the Water Cooler Podcast. I'm your host, Clarence Moy, and today I'm bringing you my interview with acclaimed director Derek Cianfrance. Now, after breaking out in a big way with 2010's indie smash, Blue Valentine, Derek continues to pursue emotionally raw and challenging projects that aren't afraid to highlight the darker side of the human experience. And his latest is no exception. Based on the acclaimed novel by Wally Lamb, HBO's I Know This Much Is True features Mark Ruffalo in a dual performance as twin brothers dealing with a legacy of family tragedy. Derek directs from his own screenplay and perfectly captures the spirit of the novel, along with a career-best performance from Ruffalo. Here, Derek talks to me about what attracted him to the project and how it allowed him to explore personal tragedy through his art. He also talks about guiding actors through such challenging material and what within the 90-set series resonates with our modern culture. So sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Derek Cianfrance, director of HBO's upcoming limited series I Know This Much Is True, which does premiere this Sunday night. And don't forget to subscribe to the Water Cooler Podcast if you don't already, as we head into the heart of the 2020 Emmy season. We'll be featuring more interviews with high-profile Emmy contenders, including many cast members from I Know This Much Is True. So stay safe and enjoy this Water Cooler Podcast exclusive interview with Derek Cianfrance.
Hey, Derek.
Hello, Clarence.
How are you?
Hey, I'm doing all right. How about yourself?
I'm doing okay. You're sheltering in place well?
I am, yes. I'm in my basement in Brooklyn. In my office, I basically sit here for like 18 hours a day trying to finish the show remotely.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you that, but since you're mentioning it now, what is it like to direct and complete, you know, such a major work remotely from isolation?
It works, right? But I feel like it's a new experience. I mean, look, it's so much of film is about collaboration, you know, and the writing process for me is very much about being internal and dreaming. But then, you know, when I shoot, it's so communal. And then when you edit, it's real communal. And we had this house in Brooklyn that we were editing out of, and there was 16 to 17 of us in this house at any given time, and different bedrooms set up as editing suites and VFX suites and sound suites. And we were just working around the clock as like a family living in this house. And, you know, we were eating meals together, and people were making birthday cakes for each other. And it was, you know, and it was beautiful. And then, you know, everything started, you know, going down around us. And, you know, we started putting in a plan in place to, you know, and we weren't finished yet, you know, a month or so ago. And so we started putting a plan in place to edit remotely. And, you know, about 4 weeks ago, everyone moved computers, all of the VFX people in all the VFX houses, you know, that used to be like 100 people sitting in a room doing VFX, they all moved home. And, you know, so right now there's, you know, hundreds of people all over the world. I mean, I have people in Belgium, you know, London, everyone, you know, people working on this show right now. And, you know, for me, yeah, it becomes a management challenge, just because I watch what everyone does, and everything ultimately comes through my room here at my house. So I spend a lot of time, waiting for assistance to remotely control my computer and put all the new material that people have been working on my computer, and then I'm able to kind of adapt it and work on it from there. And it's just, yeah, I mean, it's okay. It's a lot of balls in the air, a lot of people, you know, a lot of remote work, and, you know, a lot of Zoom calls and a lot of phone calls and a lot of FaceTimes, and, you know, everyone's just kind of working around the clock 7 days a week at all hours of the day, to try to finish it and try to kind of learn this new workflow this way. But it's, you know, people are resilient, and they they've been able to do it. We've all been able to do it. You know, the positive side is, you know, I'm home, I get to be with my family, but you know, I'm not really here either. You know, right. I'm like quarantined in my house, but it's not that different for me from large moments of life, you know, large periods of time in my life anyway. I go in the cave quite a bit to work. This is just like the most extreme example of it. And you know what's going on outside of my windows, I don't really go outside right now. I mean, I guess it came at a time that works into my workflow, and I'm hoping that I finish that society is still working outside. I can't watch the news. I can't do anything anymore. I'm just in the show.
Yeah. I can imagine.
Yeah.
So backing up a bit. So, you know, looking at your,
can I tell you though, what's hard though?
Sure.
Is ADR. I did an ADR session with one of my Italian actors who's been in Rome and under quarantine for like 7 weeks, living in a small one-bedroom apartment, unable to go outside. And, you know, that's when I do ADR with actors remotely, that's, you know, and we're just basically doing ADR on iPhones with nice microphones. And it's, you know, it's intense. It's intense to see everyone locked away. And it's affecting, you know, everyone feels a bit stir crazy. So to work with my Italian actor who's been in the middle of real crisis for, you know, longer than we have here, it was at one point just like I felt bonded with him, and another point I was concerned for him, and then another point I was like, well, we got to get this work done, and to get a performance out of people, you know, in this state is challenging too.
Yeah.
I digress.
No. That's a great point. I can't even imagine, you know, being able to get it's such a risk to get for ADR to get like a reliable sound outside of a studio setting. You know, I mean, so that it doesn't sound completely like out of tone from the rest of the dialogue.
There's a lot of training that we have to do. I mean, I've been doing ADRs with Mark Ruffalo, where he's literally under the covers of his under a blanket recording to muffle the sound. But then his computer has been heating up with all that heat, and so we did a great ADR session last week with him, and got all this material that had a fan. It was muffled nicely, but it had a fan noise because the computer was trying to cool itself down. So we had to redo it all on it. You know, so there's a lot of trial and error, but it's sounding remarkably good. I mean, you know, we feel like we're on a bit of a space mission here. It's like trying to duct tape the spaceship, you know, as we're in outer space, and just keep it going.
So backing up a bit, what was it about this novel that drew you to write and direct it and produce it? What attracted you to the novel?
The first thing that attracted me was Ruffalo. You know, he was a little backwards way of doing things, but he had the rights to the novel, and he approached me and asked me if I wanted to do it. And I love Mark so much as a human being and as an actor. He's always been one of my favorites. So I would jump at the opportunity to work with him. Then the novel for me was, it's so much about what I make films about, which is family, right? It's about the bonds of family and the burden of those bonds at times. I'm a brother. I have an older brother, had a younger sister who recently passed away, and I understand that kind of what it means to be a sibling. And and I just felt, I just really related to kind of the crisis of being a sibling and being a family member of someone. And I also really related to the idea of caretakers. You know, my sister who recently passed away, she was a caretaker. She ran assisted living facilities. And so I was always kind of, as I always watched her, I always thought that she was a person who, you know, she had this trait of a caretaker that would take care of others, but not herself. Mm-hmm. And that was something that I really wanted to explore with this character of Dominic, you know, the idea of the caretaker who can't care for himself. And then beyond that, I was also really interested in this, in exploring my my ancestry, Italian American heritage. You know, Mark and I were really connected on that aspect of this. We both come from Italian American families, and a lot of kind of the traditions and the expectations of what it means to be a man in an Italian family was something that we'd always kind of reverberated within us. And I've always been interested in making stories about like generational impact on people and kind of the choices that our ancestors made, how we kind of live in those choices. And so this story, this novel really, really, and I don't know how far you've seen yet, but eventually, you know, it really comes a lot of, it becomes about, his, you know, Dominic's grandfather's story, who's an immigrant from Italy. And I think a lot about generational trauma and how the actions of the past affect the present, and legacy. And so it was, you know, honestly, when I read the book, it just felt like something I was born to make. And it felt like my, you know, the kind of the intimate secrets inside of a family. I felt like it was, that was my, that's what I'm, that's kind of been my mission as a filmmaker.
Yeah, I've only seen the four episodes that have been released for screening at this point, but I was
okay, yeah.
And I haven't read the novel, so all of this is a surprise to me as I'm discovering the series. But I'm glad to hear that there is an exploration of his grandfather, considering all of the time spent, you know, with the story that they have passed down, and then the Juliette Lewis character, you know, reacting so strongly to him as sort of a toxic male presence in through the writing.
Yes.
It's really interesting. I can't wait to see that visually.
Yes. I had a great grandpa who I never knew, but, I know a few stories about him, and, the grandfather's story is part of my, represented like part of my desire to want to, unfurl that history in my own life. And to think, you know, it's this idea of like epigenetics, right? Mm-hmm. Like they've been like read about tests they've done on mice where they'll let a mouse, smell like sage. And every time the mouse smells sage, they'll give it a slight electric shock, you know? And then that mouse will have babies, and its babies will stay away from sage. And they'll never shock the babies, but the babies, just a switch turns in them. And I think a lot about ancestry in that way, you know, and not this idea of evolution that takes necessarily thousands of years to develop, but this idea of this epigenetics, which can switch on like a light switch inside of our DNA and affect future generations. And you know, I really started thinking about all that as I became a father myself. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about the things beyond nurturing that I was going to hand to my children. And I really started to become fascinated with that exploration of my own past and legacy. And that's what, and that was one of the things that was so exciting to me about this, is that Dominic gets this opportunity to read his grandfather's story.
Right.
This man who was always this just a legend to him and kind of find out what the real story was and to find out what's hidden in that story and maybe find some answers as to why he and his brother are the way they are. And then this, not to spoil it, but sometimes the stories don't answer the questions the way we expect them to, and they mm-hmm. don't always add up. I'll be excited for you to see it.
Yeah, I can really relate to that. I didn't know my own grandfathers. They both passed well before I was born. One of them by his own hand. So it's always been sort of it's always been sort of a hole. There's just not much information, there's not much information that has been shared with me. So it that was a compelling piece to the story to kind of go on a similar journey that I eventually would like to go on. So
I mean, there's this idea of like protecting the past, yeah. right? Like we don't talk about it. It's too like shameful or something to talk about it. But, and then if you look at our, our country, there's a lot of shameful stuff that happened, here. I mean, what happened to Native Americans, slavery, there's a lot of legacy in America that's not, that's here with us today.
Yes.
And sometimes we talk about it and sometimes we don't, but there's a lot of shameful stuff that I think in families too, that gets swept under the rug. Don't talk about that. We don't talk about that because it's like some sort of betrayal to family. And I think what I've tried to do and has always been a balancing act for me and my work is to explore those kind of secrets and the shame within a family, mm-hmm. the things we don't talk about, the things that stay in this house, and put those things on display because everyone has families and everyone has those secrets in their families and everyone has those things that we don't talk about that doesn't leave this house. And so that's been, that's the way I've been able to kind of deal with those own things in my own family and my own history. Is to work it into these films that I make.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about Mark's performance and how you work with yes. him through that. I mean, naturally, he brought the material to you. He saw something in this material that he wanted to explore as an actor. As a director, you've worked with actors through challenging material before. Blue Valentine, of course, comes to mind. How do you work with Mark to keep him sort of going off the deep, keep from going off the deep end, considering, how intense, nearly every scene he's in, it's just such dark material. It's a very aggressively deep, I'm struggling for the right word, but it's very intense what he goes through. How do you work with an actor to kind of negotiate that and to keep it sort of from impacting their persona?
How do I keep him as a human being sane through all of this?
Yeah, how do you keep him from going to method?
Well, I try to create a really safe environment for him, but that environment is also I'm going to push him and everyone else as far as I can push them because I'm going to push myself that far as well, mm-hmm. right? The idea is to go as far to the edge as we can without falling off.
Right.
And day one, the first day of shooting of our 116-day shoot was a 20-page dialogue scene, the scene at the end of episode 2 in Dr. Patel's office.
Yes.
Right?
Great scene.
So day one... Thank you. Here we go. Show up first day. We're gonna start with the one of the most challenging scenes for two actors. And something that for me as a filmmaker, I've never had the opportunity to make a 20-minute scene. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the benefits of shooting on for television is that I can really expand space in different places. And so anyway, so we start on that scene and, Mark was great out of the gate. Him and Archie were both great, but it felt to me a little stagey, you know, felt a little theatrical. Mm-hmm. I felt like if I went to the theater and saw this, I would think this is great. But it didn't quite yet feel like movie to me, right? Not that, you know, it just didn't feel quite broken down enough, right? He didn't seem, his character didn't quite seem as challenged or disturbed or affected or broken. Broken, that's the only way I could think of is broken. And so we shot that scene and I kept working on it and we just kept going into it. And near the middle third of the day, you know, two thirds of the day, Mark and I went out to a rooftop and, you know, he was smoking a cigarette because, you know, I guess that's how he went method. And he, you know, and he was like, are we almost done or something? And I said, remember, don't ever forget you asked me to do this. Right. And I was like, this is your fault. Right. Because I just don't know any other way rather than to just, you know, I just have my father gave me a crazy work ethic where, you know, if we were going to trim the evergreen bushes in our backyard, we were going to clean up every little bit of, you know, pine needle that came off of them in the ground and the rocks with our hands. You know what I mean? So my father gave me this work ethic. So I just go for it. And I want to protect my actors because I love them. Mm-hmm. But I also am looking for a place and I'm nothing without the actors. It isn't about me when I'm making a film. I'm just trying to find the most truthful moments I can find. And I'm also trying to find the moments that can only take place one time, right? I'm truly trying to find like Haley's Comet every time I shoot, right? I'm trying to find the performance that we could never go back in a million years to find this take again. Now, a perfect example for that is when Melissa Leo tells Mark to take care of his brother in mm-hmm. the first episode. And, you know, Mark has this amazing, beautiful moment when he's trying to like stay strong and be positive and be bright for his dying mother. And then he gets burdened with this responsibility and he can't hold it together. And he tries to still be bright and through his sadness and tears. And that's something that just happened because we were in this moment and the shot felt right. That was supposed to take place at nighttime. We were going to shoot that later on in the week. And it just felt the moment was right. So I whispered to Melissa, tell him, you know, have him make you the promise now. And so it kind of caught Mark off guard. And that's why there's no coverage in that scene of Melissa. It's only on Mark because it was the first time that it happened mm-hmm. and it was fresh and there was no way ever to get it again. Right.
Right.
Meanwhile, like in the Patel office, you know, we shot that 35 times, you know, to get it to that place. And, so that's just, you know, to find the moment that we couldn't repeat, you know, and so right. that was, so it's, to me, it's sometimes about the first takes, you know, give you this kind of surprise where, you know, it's like truly alive. And later takes sometimes feel like you have to erode the moment and you have to erode all of the preconceived notions that people might have coming into it, you know, as an actor, as a performer, and you just have to get down to the essence of what the scene is. And so, you know, I think Mark, he was, you know, I don't think I've ever, I mean, with this, you know, the most kind of critical thing for him, and there was like a scene where he had to run across a speeding highway. Mm-hmm. And so when his physical body comes in harm's way, it's like we have to orchestrate that within an inch of its life and just know because it's a stunt, you know. And then sex scenes are the same way. We have to orchestrate them in a very safe way. But then there's other emotional things where I am, you know, in fact, looking for that place where there's no longer a performance happening. It's like behavior, right? Like the actor the actor and the character have become one, mm-hmm. and what we're seeing is like a behavior that we're capturing, no longer a performance. And you know, but the, I get to say that the most dangerous thing for Mark was gaining the weight, you know, because he lost 20 pounds to play Dominic, and then he gained 30 pounds to play Thomas. And I just wanted to make sure, you know, we had a nutritionist on set to make sure he didn't develop any kind of, you know, I don't know, high blood sugar or something in doing that. So, I mean, I really want to take care of my actors, but I also want them to be human on the screen. And they kind of know that when we start working together. And so they just have to trust me, and I have to trust them. And you know, and I come up with certain rules, which is, you know, a simple rule, which is like, if I ever want you to, if you ever want another take, you can do it. But if I ever want another take, you have to do it, right? And if you want to try anything in a scene, I let an actor try anything they want. But at the same time, if I have something I want them to try, they have to do it too, right? So there's no, we get to a like a purely creative place where every impulse is valid and worth exploring. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, for as hard as it seems on the screen, it's also like cathartic, you know, for the actors and for myself to go through, you know, as you know, this stuff, you know, like, it's, you know, they're having an opportunity to kind of live their life in the fullest emotional way possible, you know. So it's, you know, I think as hard as it is in some of these scenes, it feels to me like we're all on vacation together. You know, we're having like the greatest time of our life, even though it's really, really, you know, challenging and emotional and intense. It still feels like, wow, when we're done, when we're going through it, it's the greatest joy of life, honestly. I'd be interested. You'd have to ask Mark what he thinks about that, but I would, or any of the actors, but I bet that they would think the same thing. I think for me, making films, being on set, shooting, working with actors feels like the most alive I get to be. Mm-hmm. You know, more so than I am in my normal life, for sure.
Particularly considering you're now sequestered in their basement and, you know, not interacting with anybody.
Yes. True. I'm watching all this life on the screen. But honestly, that's not that much different than like large parts of my childhood, too. I mean, movies were always the way that I kind of saw the world. My whole life,
yep.
I spent so much time watching, as I'm sure you did too.
Oh,
experiencing,
sure.
Witnessing things.
Yeah, I grew up in basically in the middle of nowhere, and so when we got our satellite dish, we had one of those enormous, like SETI looking satellite dishes in our backyard, and it was like opening up a whole window to a place, you know, places I'd never even conceived of. You know, it's a huge thing on an 8-year-old, 7-year-old child.
What year were you born?
75.
Yeah, I'm 74, so we're the same generation.
Yep.
I didn't have the satellite dish, but 7-8 years old, I had cable box.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. You know, and HBO, and holy shit, like, yep. that old theme song to HBO would come piping in, and it was like amazing to think like what's gonna come on next, and I just pop a VHS tape in there and record it. And just, you know, then just watch over and over again all these movies. I think we came, you know, the new generation, they have a whole nother set of reference, you know, for how they're experiencing it. But I think we're that VHS cable satellite generation.
Absolutely. Anyway. So, looking at the story, you know, obviously you've got this tremendous performance from Mark, but then you also have this fantastic company of female actors who are working with him in so many different scenes. You've got Archie, you've got Rosie, you've got Melissa, you've got Juliet. How do you think those different female perspectives influence the story and influence his character's trajectory?
Well, Well, yeah, first off, I feel like I got to work with the greatest cast of all time. You know, Wally had written this, you know, this character, Dominic, and surrounded him with, you know, all these women in his life, between his mother, between his ex-wife, between his live-in girlfriend, between, you know, the you know, his brother's therapist, between, you know, Lisa Sheffer, the, you know, his advocate at the mental health facility. And that, you know, that was what Wally had written. And I thought it was an amazing opportunity to explore his masculinity through these women. Right. And the toxicity of his masculinity through these women. And that's one of the things that comes up in the later episodes as he finds his grandfather's stories. You start really seeing the kind of, this misogyny that he was, you know, that wasn't natural, you know, or that was part of his ancestry not that long ago. You know, his grandfather's only one generation removed from him. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was so important to surround him with these women who are stronger than him, who are more clear about what's going on in the world, who see him more clearly, and who are in a lot of ways caretakers. All of them represent some sort of person who is not necessarily trying to take care of Dominic. They're trying to help him, but they're also trying to wake him up to take care of himself. And you know, then that comes, you know, then and so I, you know, I tried to cast all those roles with actors that were, to me, just like my favorite actors and some of my favorite people, and for the most part, really funny people. Right, that's one of the things about how heavy that, you know, this content can be. I always wanted to make sure the show has had a sense of humor to it as well, and so that's why I cast Catherine as Dessa. Mm-hmm. You know, because I mean, not only because she's funny as hell, but she's also like a raw nerve. Catherine is like pulsating with life. She's so ultra alive. And then you got Juliette Lewis, who's like one of the all-time great actors, you know, and I'd always dreamed of working with her ever since I saw her in Cape Fear.
Oh yeah.
And you know, Melissa Leo, who's just, you know, one of the great actors who disappears into all of her roles. And then Rosie O'Donnell, who's hilarious. And yeah, anyway, so I tried to surround him with these strong characters. And you know, the fact that they're women, you know, that was just from what Wally wrote.
Right.
I just tried to then cast the best actors, the most alive and the most kind of ornery people in those roles to really fight Dominic, because he goes to battle with every one of those characters. Mm-hmm. And he wrestles them, and it's I don't know, I thought it becomes like a different kind of buddy movie. I mean, I guess he's got, you know, I know he's got his buddy in the show. He's got Rob Hubel, who's also, you know, I cast him from a Olive Garden commercial that I'd seen that he had done. You know, so I thought he could bring some humor to it too. I thought he was just the perfect Leo because he had really done that, you know, a real Olive Garden commercial. It's a different kind of a buddy movie in a new way for me to explore that masculinity, because ultimately what I'm trying to look for in my movies too is, but you know, the man, that the idea of being a man is just different. mm-hmm. now. You know what I mean? It's so different than it was not so long ago. And the idea of what's strong and what's weak is also much different. And so Dominic is kind of in this crossroads in understanding what it means to be strong and what it means to let go and what it means to, and you know, women are just in large part more evolved and stronger, I mean, than men are in general, at least the women I know in my life, my mom, my wife, my mother-in-law, my aunt, they're all, my sister, they're all so much stronger than me. And so, and yet it's, you know, societally, you know, I wasn't raised to think that way. So I thought all these women were, you know, would just need to have very, very strong people surrounding him. And I don't know, does that make sense to you?
No, it absolutely does. Yeah. And it's really interesting, you know, hearing the, you know, what's sort of behind casting, you know, these actresses like Catherine and Rosie, who are great mm-hmm. dramatic performers, but also have tremendous comedic sides, sort of, you know, have that sort of inner fire within them. Because, you know, as through Rosie's line readings, I mean, she's very deadly serious in a lot of it, but there's also this undercurrent of, there's just something there that kind of taps into some inner sarcasm or some inner mm-hmm. inner humor within her. She's such a great dramatic actress. She never gets credit for it, and she is tremendous in this.
I agree. Just wait till the next two episodes. She's amazing.
Awesome.
One other thing about the masculinity, I just would say is like mm-hmm. one thing I discovered in working with Mark is Dominic is like day three, he was doing a phone call and I couldn't quite find the moment. I couldn't quite find the scene. And so I said, "Hey, Mark, do 50 push-ups." And Mark, being the kind of guy that he is and the kind of actor that he is, like, didn't fight me on it, didn't ask me why am I doing this. He just went to the ground, did 50 push-ups, and then did this phone call. And it was kind of interesting because all of a sudden he was a little out of breath. His breath was kind of short, mm-hmm. you know, and shallow. And I could see, like, the veins in his neck. It was like engorged, and I was like, "Hey, that was after we're done with the take." I was like, "Then let's do that again. Do another 50." He was like, "Why am I doing push-ups right now?" And I was like, "Just go for it." And so we started doing this for Dominic the whole time. Most of the scenes that you see of Dominic in the show, the little secret behind it is that he just did 50 push-ups. And what it did is it gave him this, like, really strong chest. You know, his chest was out. He's, like, real, like, presented himself as a man. He was, you know, in veins, engorged all the time, shallow breath, just, like, wired and angsty and ready to go. I mean, something about men and their pectorals, you know? And when we went to do Thomas, you know, that was 6 weeks later, 30 pounds Mark had gained. And I told him in that time, I was like, "You can't do any push-ups now." Right. So he came back as Thomas, and Thomas was all about, like, letting his belly go, you know? So he just sunk down anyway, but we were trying to just deal with masculinity on, like, a physiological level, right? Where it's just like about his body and how his body was. And, you know, Thomas was always, as Mark used to say, was always the more feminine brother, you know, is one of the things that Ray hated about him, mm-hmm. his masculine, you know, man raising, you know, stepfather raising him in the house, trying to make him be strong, be angry, be on top all the time. And whereas Thomas was not that. Thomas was, anyway, yeah.
So I have one more question for you. You know, as you're talking about, this kind of dovetails into what you just talked about with Thomas being the more effeminate or more feminine version of the twins. Yeah. You know, one thing that he struggles with in the film, and the film is very much set in the early 90s, and so you've got, you know, his anxiety over Bush, you've got his anxiety over the Iraq War. He's very, I don't know if he's politically savvy, but he's at least aware of the political tensions in the world. Do you think, you know, how do you think that reflects, you know, on our current political environment?
I mean, I think, I'll say, I don't ever consider myself a political filmmaker, but I am an American.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm making movies, I'm making American movies, about our country, so and about the people in our country. The one thing I will say, the week after Mark gave me this book, I had a babysitter who's had a family member who had lit himself on fire because he wanted to draw everyone's attention to the war that was still going on in Afghanistan.
Wow.
And of course, nobody paid attention to him, right? Nobody cared. No one knew about it, except me and this guy's family, and now the guy who now lives with third degree burns. And I thought that was a real jumping off point for me, for Thomas, to think about this guy who
with the hand.
Wants the war to stop. Yeah. And in some ways, Thomas is, you know, he's a seer. He's a seer. He's a prophet. He know, so much of what he is worried about happens.
Right.
And he's trying to stop. He's trying to make a sacrifice. And in his mind, if he lops off his hand, people will say, oh, we've got to, this is so, he believes so strongly in what he's doing that he thinks the world's going to take notice too. And care about him and listen to him, and it's the right thing that's going to happen. And he has to go that far for the world to understand and to wake up. But of course, the world keeps going on. And I think, you know, it was making this show was there was so many eerie things that happened or synchronistic things that happened. The first day that we shot Thomas turned out to be September 11th. You know, just happened that way in the schedule that mm-hmm. the first day that Thomas shot, September 11th, 2019. And, you know, Mark, I remember on set that day, he was so scared to be Thomas. He put on all this weight and he was like hiding in his trailer. He wouldn't come to set. And I finally got him out of his trailer and walked him to set. And I remember when I walked with him on set, I remember the whole crew was like in awe and gasping about like, oh geez, what's, like they couldn't believe it was like a totally different guy. It wasn't Mark anymore. It wasn't the Mark that we knew who was Dominic. It was like, we didn't know who this person was. Right. And he sat down on set and, my assistant director, Dylan, said, let's all, before we start shooting, take a moment of silence for September 11th, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Mark, as Thomas, started to say a prayer for America. And I nudged my camera operator to start rolling in the middle of this moment of silence as he prayed for America. And it just was chilling to feel like the story that Thomas was trying to stop eventually became September 11th. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And eventually became this crisis that we've been in as a country for forever. Or, you know, since this time in the 90s. And so Thomas is prophetic in a lot of ways. And he, you know, one of the things that Mark and I used to talk about when we were shooting Thomas is that Thomas is telling the truth.
Right.
People just can't see it yet.
Yep.
You know, they can't see it. Sometimes he goes too far, but he is a truth teller. And sometimes the truth is too much for people to take. So yeah, if we could go back in the time machine to the 90s and Thomas was a real guy and he made the sacrifice and we all listened to it, our world today would be different. He could have changed the world. You know, we just didn't listen. And the world would have had its own other problems, obviously. But he just needs to be listened to. That's what we tried to pay Thomas that kind of respect the whole time when we were shooting, and not make him crazy and not make him the crazy guy.
Right.
You know, we wanted to make him the truth teller.
Not a stereotype.
Yes.
Well, Derek, this has been just an incredibly illuminating conversation about the film, which I really enjoyed. So thank you very much
thank
for
you.
Your time, and thank you for all that you're doing right now. And stay safe, of course.
Thank you. You too, man. And maybe when this all clears up, I'll see you face-to-face one day.
That would be great. Take care.
Okay. I take care, man. Bye.
Bye.